All right, guys, you are locked on Falcons. I am your host, Aaron Freeman, and today I am answering listener questions pertaining to the all 22 that I saw of the Falcons win over the Los Angeles Rams in the wild card round of the NFL playoffs.
You are locked on Falcons, your daily podcast on the Atlanta Falcons, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
All right, guys, I'm Aaron Freeman, host of Locked On Falcons, founder of FalcFans.com, one of the longest-running Falcon websites on the interwebs. And today we are doing our Q&A, our All-22 review of this last week's win over the Rams. I'll be answering listener questions. People submitted these questions on Twitter, Facebook, email. And then you also have the potential to submit them in commentary on the websites where this podcast is posted. I will detail where you can send those in case you're wondering, you're new to this podcast and you're wondering, hey, Aaron, I thought this was a cool idea, and you interacting with your listenership and your and fellow fans and answering their questions. Next time you do this, I would like to participate in this. Well, of course, you can do so by sending your podcast related questions to FalcFans. That's my Twitter handle. Just let me know it's podcast related when you send it there. Otherwise, the easiest way to tell it's podcast related is just go ahead and send it to the show's Twitter handle at Locked On Falcons. If you don't like Twitter character limits or you're not on Twitter, of course, you can check us out on Facebook. Locked On Falcons is the Facebook page. Give us a like while you're there. You can also do email. LockedOnFalcons@mail.com is the email address. And of course, you can post comments on FalcFans.com and LockedOnFalcons.com, where this podcast is posted daily. As regular listeners know, I try to keep these Q&As under 30 minutes. Probably this one will be closer to 40 minutes as I drag out this intro. But because of that, it does mean I always get a lot of good questions from people, and there's potential ones that I will not get to on tonight's episode. And you guys know that you can check out any of the quote-unquote leftovers that I do not get on tonight's episode on LockedOnFalcons.com. I will post that. I will try to post that on Friday, the day before the Falcons-Eagles game, so that you guys can sort of simmer on that and taste those delicious leftovers before Saturday's action. So, that all being said, let's jump right in. First question comes from Young Zach at Young Zach on Twitter. He asks, don't you think you should mention the lack of respect we get on the national media front this week on the podcast? All of them labeled us out, and half of them don't watch our games. Honestly, I don't think it deserves to be mentioned. I don't really, not to sound like a dismissive douche, but the whole lack of respect that the Falcons get from the national media is kind of a tired narrative and tired story, at least from my perspective. Again, I can only speak from personal experience. And part of the reason why I do this podcast and one of the reasons why I started up FalcFans.com oh so many years ago, the website has existed since 1999 in some form or fashion, but it was really only in 2006 where I started to take it a little bit seriously and try to contribute. And a lot of that was because I looked around nationally and locally and didn't see a whole lot of great coverage of the Falcons. And that's one of the factors that motivates me. It also is one of the factors why I have a tendency to be very critical of other people's coverage of the team, because I'm very passionate about, trying to provide the best coverage possible. And when I see other people I don't think are necessarily living up to that standard, I tend to be very critical of him. And oftentimes when I'm attacking fans, it's not necessarily you guys that are quote unquote the average fan that are listening to this podcast. It's more some of the other podcasts or other websites out there that cover the Falcons, and I don't necessarily think do a great job. So, with that being said, the point I'm trying to get to is this has been something that I've been well aware of for many, many years, for over a decade. And so this whole notion that, we don't get enough coverage and we don't get enough respect from the national media is kind of old news. If you're waking up to that reality today, okay. And I understand, the Falcons were just in the Super Bowl and they should be getting a lot more love than maybe, but honestly, Like, who cares? You know, I know clearly people care, so I don't want to be dismissive. And you know, I'm not trying to sit here and tell people that you need to adopt my worldview or anything like that. But it's, I don't know. I just find the whole, like, no one gives us respect that pretty much every fan and every fan base uses. And occasionally you'll get players and coaches using it too. I just think it's like, okay, like, all right, you know, water is wet. Like, you as a fan feel like your team doesn't get enough love and respect. It's fine. Great. You know, and if, you know, if that drives your, fuels your fire, then so be it. I'm not going to sit here and tell you, you shouldn't be that way. But, for me, it's just like, okay, like, they didn't think we beat the Rams because we've been a very inconsistent team all year, and the Rams have the best offense in the league. And generally speaking, in the postseason, people commonly make the mistake of, you know, thinking home field advantage matters a lot more than it actually does. You know, typically the numbers I've seen over the years, generally speaking, home field does matter in the conference championship game. The home team usually wins that game, but in the wild card round and the divisional round, there was a long portion. I don't think it's quite the case now, but there was a long period of time. It was like a 5 or 6 year run where it was about a 50-50 shot, whether the home team or the away team run in those first two rounds of the playoffs. So it's one of those things where, like, I think now over the last couple of years, it's sort of skewed a little bit more favorably to the home team, but still it's probably only like 60% of the time the home team wins. Look, I get the pettiness. You know, I certainly remember that Chris Harris was the only person, Broncos cornerback Chris Harris was the only person on the NFL Network pregame set last week to pick the Falcons to beat the Rams. I certainly remember that. I tweeted about it afterwards the game, gave Chris Harris a shout out on Twitter. But for me, I guess the long story of what I'm getting around to is, like, I've learned many, many years ago that those entities, NFL Network, ESPN, I watch those things for entertainment purposes, not because, as you said, Zach, they don't watch our games. They don't watch as much games. You know, they come up with generalities that, in my opinion, are meant to entertain, not necessarily always to inform. It's not to say that they're devoid of information, but that's not really what they're in the business to do. They're in the business to get viewers, to sell advertising, and to keep people's eyes glued to the TV with entertaining segments that occasionally border on analysis. And so from my perspective, like, you know, and again, this is part of the factor that motivates me. If you feel that there isn't enough good coverage out there of your favorite team, then there's nothing to, certainly today, you know, there was a lot bigger obstacles back in 2006, but certainly not a lot of obstacles. But certainly today, like, you can go out and start your own podcast. You can go out and start your own YouTube site. You can go start your own website, right? You can provide the content that you think is sorely lacking out there on the national or local standpoint yourself. That's what motivates me to do it. And so I would go to anybody else out there that if you feel like, and certainly I'm sure there are plenty of people that think they could do a better job than I can at doing this. And so there's nothing stopping you from doing that. You know, even if this podcast started back in 2011 with like three listeners. So, it's one of those things where, like, you build an audience over time, probably a little slower than I would have preferred to do, but it is what it is. Like, you know, you can go about and do something about it, Zach. So rather than saying, like, oh, woe is us and playing the victim card, I guess, of we don't get enough respect and blah, 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 you know, do something about it. All right. Hopefully I didn't start the show off too antagonistically there with you, Zach. All right, before we move on to the next question, you got to know that the NFL playoffs are finally here, and I want to tell you guys about mybookie.ag, the number one rated online sportsbook. With your fantasy football season over, the only way to use that sports knowledge to win cash is by betting at MyBookie, the sportsbook that makes it easy to deposit and even easier to cash out on your winnings fast. They have odds on everything. Live betting and an all-new prop builder. Create your own bet slips. Bet how you want. You already bet your friends that LeBron is going to go for 30 and 10 tonight. Why not bet at MyBookie and put your money where your mouth is? Bet from your desktop, tablet, or their world-class mobile site that lets you bet anytime, anywhere. MyBookie offers the fastest, no-hassle payouts when you win. Join now and MyBookie will match your deposit with up to a 50% bonus. Just use that promo code LOCKEDON When you're making your account, visit mybookie.ag today and bet on the internet's favorite sports book where you play, you win, and you get paid. All right. Brandon Rich at Brand the Builder asks, what does the film say about Truman Kovlish Saturday? I thought he did well not getting tricked or being beat deep, no splash slash chunk play. Well, he did give up a 38-yarder to Robert Woods in late in the second quarter that set up that final field goal for the Rams in the two-minute offense. But I don't necessarily blame him for that because the Falcons were playing cover three on that particular play, and the Rams did a good job of sort of attacking it because they lined up Robert Woods in the slot. They lined up tight end Gerald Everett on the outside where Trufant was cover, was over him. I wouldn't necessarily say covering him, and Neal was more in the slot. And so when you play the cover three, the outside corner, in this case Trufant, is supposed to cover the deep outside third of the field, typically, you know, from the seams outside the numbers to the sideline. And so Woods ran as the inside receiver, as a slot receiver, Woods ran a vertical route down the seam while Everett sort of sat in the flat. Because of the cover three, Keanu Neal, being the inside guy, is supposed to cover that flat while Trufant covers the deep outside third. And because Woods was had inside position because he was lined up inside, it's hard to for the outside corner to make that adjustment to cover that inside. And so one of the reasons that, you know, one of the routes that you try to deploy against cover three to beat cover three are some of those deeper in-breaking routes where you settle in behind the linebackers and between the outside corner and that free safety. And that's basically, even though Wood didn't run an in-breaking route, running that seam, and with Goff throwing a really great pass to him inside, away from Trufant. Trufant tried his best to close and break up the pass, but it was just a great pass, a good route combination. So even though, you know, live, a lot of people were like, oh, Trufant got burned again, man, he's terrible, blah, 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 blah. You know, that really was more an the vulnerability inherently into the scheme, more so than Trufant getting beat. And I said this after the game on Twitter. I think a lot of, certainly hit some of the recent breakdowns that Trufant has had, including that Ted Ginn touchdown versus New Orleans, has been more due to teams exploiting vulnerabilities in the Falcons coverage. On that Ginn play, I said it on the previous All-22 review, I think, that I thought that was really Ricardo Allen sort of leaving Trufant out to dry without any safety help over the middle when the Falcons were playing man coverage. And I think, you know, the notion that Trufant's been declining or he's been bad this year or the Falcons overpaid, which has been a very common narrative that you'll see in certain corners of Falcons Twitter. You have heard very prominent, relatively prominent members of the local Falcons media, whether that's print or radio, being very critical of Trufant's play this year. I think all that stuff is very overblown. Surprise, surprise. Guess what? Aaron has the contrary opinion. But in this case, Aaron has the right opinion. You know, Trufant, you know, I think has played excellent this season. He's given up a few more big plays than I think people are used to. But, you know, cornerbacks get beat. And, you know, you look around the league, the average quarterback in the league today completes 63% of his passes. So 63% of the time, someone's getting beat. And so there's no reason to get your feathers all ruffled because on this particular play it happened to be one guy. When it happens over and over and over again, then it becomes problematic. But when you play as much man coverage as the Falcons do, those times when you quote-unquote get exposed are going to look a lot worse than they would if you were playing zone and you're asked to keep things in front of you and underneath. You know, you look at the numbers from Pro Football Focus, both Alford and Trufant have allowed 57% completion rates this year, which is on the same level, the same exact rate that Darius Slay and Marcus Peters, two Pro Bowlers, have had. Now, you know, the difference is Trufant's given up 6 touchdowns this year while Alford's only given up 3. But Trufant gave up 3 touchdowns and allowed 59% completions against them in 9 games last year. So technically he was kind of on pace to give up 6 touchdowns last year. And, you know, it's not really a drop-off from a year ago. Alford's numbers last year was 61% completions and 7 touchdowns he gave up last year. And so he gave up a lot of touchdowns as well, in addition to the abundance of penalties early in the season. So it's very clear to me, you know, my analysis here is, and this is where I'm going to be a little dismissive of other fans' opinions and other media members' opinions, but I think a lot of this stuff is driven by the, you know, the backlash against Alford last year and the backlash against Trufant this year. I think a lot of it is driven by the quote-unquote splash plays. And what ends up happening is people see the quote, whether the high, the good plays or the bad plays, people have a tendency to overreact to those things. People, you know, they only remember the touchdowns that Alford gave up or the penalties that Alford drew, or in this case, this year, Trufant has given up. But they don't really remember all the positive plays that way outnumber those negative ones. No one remembers the 26 times a quarterback has tried to throw at Trufant this year and did not complete a pass, with half of those being pass breakups by Trufant. No one remembers the 483 times, according to Pro Football Focus, that Trufant lined up in coverage and his man was not thrown to at all. So the 483 times he was quote-unquote successful playing coverage versus the, you know, 30-some-odd times where he got beat and the 6-some-odd times where he gave up a touchdown. You know, you look at Pro Football Focus's metrics in terms of how many times he's targeted per snap when he's in coverage. Trufant's a top 10 corner this year and has been a top 10 corner back pretty consistently the last couple of years. I think back in 2015, he was, you know, this year he's like eighth. And I think in 2015, he was like third or something like that. But like, you know, that, oh, big drop off. He went from third to eighth best or whatever. So I think much has been made of Trufant's quote unquote struggles this year. And I think it's been greatly, greatly overrated. He's given up a couple of touchdowns. No big deal. All right, Robin It at Robin It 82, or is it Rob In It? Looks like it's Rob In It. Sorry, Rob. Can you examine the touchdown throw from the Rams? Was that definitely Poole's responsibility? In general, how did he fare in coverage? Would he make a better safety than nickel corner after seeing 2 full years of tape? Yes, that was Poole's responsibility. The Rams ran a well-executed rub route against him, and no. Contrary to what some people may think, that was, the refs were right to not throw the flag. That was a perfectly executed rub route that should not have drawn a flag at all. That's how you draw it up. That's exactly how you execute it. That's a coaching clinic right there type of play when you run that rub route. So, you know, it's hard to beat rub routes. And we've talked about this in the past where when you play as much man coverage as the Falcons do, rub routes, you're going to be particularly vulnerable to those types of things, particularly in the red zone. Where they're very, you know, a lot more effective than they are, you know, on a first and 10 play from your own 36-yard line, generally speaking. So I think other than that play, I thought Poole did pretty good. I think part of it was the Falcons played a lot of cover three in this game, particularly in the second half. And I think that's really where sort of that zone really is where Poole's strength lies, more so than pure man coverage. But, you know, I thought, you know, when they were playing man coverage outside of that one play. And even then, again, I certainly am more forgiving of him on that one play because it was a rub route. I thought he did pretty well. Obviously, he made a lot of impactful plays in run support as well. As to your second question in Poole moving to safety, I've always thought ever since his days at Florida that Poole would make a pretty good safety in the scheme. I remember talking about that after we signed him in undrafted free agent. I remember on the other podcast I do, Falcon Central Radio, it was either May or June of his rookie season, right after the draft. And I basically said, I think you can make an argument that Brian Poole has a higher upside as a free safety than Ricardo Allen does, just because he's a lot more physical of a player in terms of run support and whatnot. And I like Poole a lot at Florida because of his toughness. You know, he was a little bit vulnerable in coverage his last year at Florida, largely because Tease Tabor and Vernon Hargreaves and Keanu Neal and Marcus May, all of whom I think were first, second, or third round picks over the next two drafts, were the other DBs in their main nickel coverage. And so it was very, made a lot of sense for teams to be like, oh, Brian Poole's the weak link here. Let's target him. So, you know, he gave up a lot of plays. I remember when I was watching the all 22 of Keanu Neal at Florida, Poole constantly was sort of at the brunt end of, and so that sort of always had me sort of like, okay, he has a certain ceiling as a man corner. He can play it. He can play nickel. He's got experience playing in the slot, but I wouldn't necessarily say his long-term future projects there. But I will have to say he's certainly outplayed my expectations, not only last season, but as well as this year. Part of the reason why I infamously was on the, we shouldn't cut Jalen Collins bandwagon back in August and throughout most of this season, most of the season that he was on the team. I was ride or die Jalen Collins to the very end. I'd still welcome back to Atlanta if given that opportunity. You know, that's crazy old me. But part of the reason why I was sort of on that bandwagon with Jalen Collins was because I wasn't fully, I was very skeptical of whether Poole could sort of handle the upgrade in terms of the quality of slot receivers that we were going to face this upcoming season. And I think he's done an admirable job. He hasn't been perfect by any means, but I think he's done his job as well as I could have possibly expected. Now, as I mentioned earlier, you have a relatively low number of completions that Alford and True give up in this scheme, with a lot of emphasis on man coverage. But on the other hand, when you look at Poole's completion percentage allowed, he's allowed 84% completion, which, when you look at the roughly 90 cornerbacks that are starters or nickel cornerbacks in the league, that's actually dead last in the league, 84%. I don't think that number should necessarily define the quality of Brian Poole's play, because I do think he's contributed in a lot of other ways. And I think a lot of those receptions are sort of short, deke and dunk sort of passes, which when you're his type of player, you're going to give up those and make the tackle. And I think he's done that quite a bit, and you'll limit the yards after catch. But clearly, you know, there is room for improvement there. You know, you want to get that number down to 60% or something like that, ideally. So I certainly think, you know, while other people may be dismissive of the Falcons using a high pick on a cornerback, potentially a first round pick on a cornerback, if the right defensive tackle is not there, I think that makes a lot of sense. I think, you know, ideally you want, if Alford and Trufant are Aqib Talib and Chris Harris, then you want to find the Bradley Roby in the scheme to really push your coverage and your secondary over the top, and give you legitimately the best secondary in the league. And then you can play as much man coverage as you want, and then you can blitz guys all the time. I think it helps your defense long term. But that being said, I do think Poole being able to move from cornerback to safety makes sense. I think we've seen this season the Falcons have wanted to see their safety drop into the slot and cover a lot more. Allen has gotten more opportunities. Obviously, he got a lot of those opportunities during that portion of the season when Poole and Trufant were injured, but they were already doing that earlier in the season. And I think the reason for that, the reason why that makes sense, and I think it's one of the reasons why they looked at a guy like Kazee trying to convert a cornerback to that role at free safety behind Allen, is it makes a lot of sense, because it ultimately gives you the flexibility that when other teams go to their three wide receiver sets, you don't have to go out of your base defense. You don't have to bring a third cornerback on the field, because your free safety can also play slot corner. And, we talked about this, I think, with Corey on the recent episode. But one of the vulnerabilities of the Falcons defense that has sort of always existed, but fortunately has not been truly exploited, partially due to the talent of the team, is that certain teams could force the Falcons to go into their three wide receiver sets by playing, or their nickel sets by playing three wide receiver sets, and then deciding, okay, because they have a softer box, typically when you play nickel, you only have six guys in the box. And you have, you know, as an offense, you get positive numbers because you got five offensive linemen, potentially a tight end and a running back. So you have basically six blockers and a running back that can make a guy miss. So you can basically handle a seven-man box, but a six-man box is advantageous if you can get a hat on a hat. And so you're vulnerable to the run that way. And certain teams that can run out of their three wide receiver sets, like the Rams, makes you a little bit vulnerable. I think I talked specifically about forcing the Falcons to go base and passing the ball. But having that free safety that can play that slot corner, long story short, is valuable, because you don't necessarily have to scramble like, oh no, they're going through. You could just drop Allen, you could drop Poole, you can drop Kazee down in the slot, kick Neal to single high, which he's comfortable playing, not necessarily the best use of his skills, but certainly he's capable of playing it, and you're good to go. And that being said, I'll wrap it up here on this question. But, you know, while you guys know that I'm a big fan of Ricardo Allen, I do think, because of the presences of guys like Poole and Kazee, I don't think the Falcons have to feel like they feel compelled to give him a long-term contract this offseason. If they did do that, I wouldn't be against it. It would make perfect sense why they did that, because if he's played so well the last couple of years and he's, you know, a prominent leader on the team, and, you know, you want to reward part of being running your team successfully is rewarding why is that word hard to say, rewarding the right players on your roster. And certainly I'm not going to make any arguments against the notion that Ricardo Allen isn't one of those guys. But I do think, you know, because he's only going to be a restricted free agent this year, you don't have to do that. You can sort of wait a year. And, you know, you see how much growth Casey shows from year one to year two. We know that that's a big year for the growth of young players in terms of what they can do and what they can't do. And because you have a guy like Poole, and if you potentially upgrade that cornerback, that nickel cornerback spot, and get another talented young cornerback in the draft, then Poole gives you the flexibility that he could sort of play both spots next year and see if he gets longer looks at free safety next summer, see how he handles that role. You know, he did play some free safety during his rookie training camp, working basically in the fourth quarter of some of those preseason games as the third string free safety behind Allen and Robinson Therese. So it makes sense. I think Poole still has a bright future. This by no means is me saying that the Falcons need to give up on Brian Poole. You know, he might wind up outlasting several of these other guys that are currently starters in the secondary and on this defense in terms of how long he'll stick in Atlanta, because he's a very valuable role player. But I think ultimately the Falcons could potentially do better at cornerback with him. And if that is the case, then I do think it does open up an opportunity that maybe he could be the heir apparent to Ricardo Allen, that, you know, a year or so from now, when you're looking at, you know, guys like Deion Jones and Grady Jarrett and Vic Beasley and whoever else on your defense that are going to deserve to be paid, you know, Allen could be one of those guys that you say, you know what, even though maybe Casey or me, even though Poole may not be quite the guy that guy was, for us the last couple of years, the drop-off is relatively minimal. And if we can save, you know, $5 million, $10 million, or $15 million over the next couple of years by not paying Allen and going with one of these younger guys, that makes a lot of sense. So that's something to watch out for. But of course I say that, and of course, you know, 2 months from now, the Falcons will give Ricardo Allen a 4 or 5 year extension, and that's all moot at that point, but we'll see how it goes. Speaking of the draft, guys, if you guys want to check out Locked On NFL Draft, both those guys, hosts John Ledger, Trevor Sikkema, they're going to be, Trevor's going to be at the East-West Shrine Game next week practices. So, definitely want to check out that show while he's giving those live update, those daily updates. And then both of those guys are going to be at the Senior Bowl the following week. So again, you definitely want to stay tuned. If you're not already subscribed to Locked On NFL Draft, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, by all means, go and subscribe now if you want to get caught up on the draft and what's going on at those All-Star Game practices. Okay, I'm being a little long-winded on these because I thought I would be maybe two more questions in. I'll probably wrap this up on this next one, just because this one is going to be another long-winded answer because it's another great question. Comes from NJ Falcons Ronin at Mave2124. Oh, this is my friend Andy. All 22 question. Even though the defense played well, I was at a loss to the game plan with Vic. It seemed like he was shadowing Goff, who isn't a running threat on many plays. On other plays, he delayed his rush. What did you see? Yeah, I think you saw what I saw. I was certainly disappointed with Vic Beasley's performance. It did seem like, you know, he got a sack in this game basically he looped around on, I don't know if it was a design stunt or delayed stunt, and sort of touched down Goff when he slipped on the field. The first sack on the second series, was basically due to field conditions, and he touched him down and got a sack. And that's sort of been basically Vic Beasley's season in a lot of ways in terms of the sacks that he's gotten this year. It did seem like he was doing that quite a bit. And I think this game in particular really sort of summarized some of the issues I've had with Vic Beasley throughout this 2017 season. I've been very public with stating that I don't think Vic Beasley has played poorly this year as a pass rusher. I still don't think that, but I do think he has been limited in a lot of ways. And I don't think the limitations that he's shown are for the same reasons that a lot of other people have been opining over the last couple of weeks and last couple of months in terms of, oh, they changed how they used him, and he's dropping in the coverage too much. And it's like he dropped in the coverage, what, 30, 40 times this year? Like, that's not making that big of a difference, guys. And this is part of my problem, you know, and not to be dismissive of other people that give opinions on the Falcons, but this is part of the reason why I tend to be dismissive, because I don't think people are really paying attention to what's going on in the games. They're just sort of looking at box scores and making judgments off of that. You know, part of the reason why, and I've talked about this before, but part of the reason why I have the opinion, certainly I came into this season, unlike a lot of Falcon fans, thinking that Vic Beasley's 2016 performance was very, very much overrated. He had the 15 and a half sacks, and I think people looked at those numbers again, thinking it meant something that it didn't really mean. And I think, you know, in specifics to this game, and I'll go deeper into my thoughts on sort of his 2017 season versus the 2016 season. But the long story short is it's going to be, I don't think his play has changed any differently from 2016 to 2017, if you've been paying attention. I think, you know, specifically to this Rams game, I do think you can make a case that field conditions may have had an impact on Vic Beasley's subpar performance in this game. There were multiple times where it seemed like him trying to, you know, get off the line of scrimmage on that first step. He was sort of stumbling and slipping a little bit. Now, I would say I don't know how much I would blame that on, because it didn't seem like it was really hurting Brooks Reed and Adrian Claiborne and Tack McKinley all too much. So, you know, clearly if it was a problem for Vic Beasley, you know, I guess the equipment guy screwed him over, because he certainly wasn't screwing over the other pass rushes the Falcons had. But, like, I think this game sort of illustrated one of the issues that Vic Beasley has had, which is he's kind of a one-note pass rusher. He's a speed rush guy. If he doesn't beat you on the first step, he's usually not going to beat you. And when he does beat you, it's going to be largely due to hustle. You know, he doesn't really have a counter move. He doesn't really use his hands particularly well to disengage and prevent guys from engaging him. You know, the offensive lineman's going to punch him when on their kick slide, and he doesn't ever really use his hands to sort of not prevent that from happening. He's just relying on his ability to run past that guy before and basically dodge the punch as opposed to knocking it down, like you see with a guy like Adrian Claiborne. Go back to the Dallas game where he just basically used that chop move on Chaz Green, you know, in addition to his first step quickness. But so when Green was, you know, the times where he didn't blow past Green, and Green tried to punch him, he chopped his hands down, and Green would get overextended, and he would just go right past him. And that's what we're talking about when we're talking about using your hands. And I think, you know, part of that is Vic Beasley doesn't have great length. He doesn't have great power. He doesn't really have ideal core strength. And so what ends up happening is when he doesn't prevent those offensive linemen from putting their hands on him, they are very effective at controlling him. And, you know, basically at that point in time, the only time he's going to win is he's going to win by out-hustling you. And you go back and you watch the six sacks he's had this year, if you factor in the one against Goff, if I'm not mistaken, I'm basing this on the top of my head, but if I'm not mistaken, five of those six sacks, I think the last one he had in the regular season, I think was the only one that wasn't the case. Five of those six sacks basically came basically off of hustle. Basically him chasing down, scrambling quarterbacks trying to step up in the pocket, quarterbacks trying to flee the pocket, quarterbacks not, you know, throwing the ball when they should have. And basically that's been his season this year. And a large percentage of his sacks last year were that way. So I think what's happened this year with Vic Beasley and it showed in this Rams game is he's tried to use the bull rush a little bit too much, but the problem is he doesn't it's not really effective because he doesn't have ideal core strength and his lower body strength is whatever. And that's really where you sort of try to generate a lot of the power that you when you use the bull rush. And he's not going to walk the offensive tackle back. He'll knock him back on the initial contact. But at that point, he doesn't have that sort of power and that drive to sort of, you know, walk that guy back into the quarterback's lap and use, you know, effectively get that pressure. And I don't say, you know, this, it sounds super like I'm being super, super critical of Vic Beasley. I like Vic Beasley a lot. But I'm evaluating him as a player and not trying to come up with these lazy narratives that other people will come up with by saying that, oh, the reason why he's struggling is because he drops in the coverage too much. And like, these were the same things I was saying a year ago. If, you know, people were dismissive of it because it's like, oh, you're Aaron, you're a hater and whatnot. But I was saying all these same things a year ago to anybody that was listening. You know, I was sitting there on the street corner saying, please believe me. No, but, and I think what's changed this year primarily, and whether, you know, in this game specifically, the field positions, you can also argue that the hamstring injury that he had earlier this season may have slowed him down a half step slower than he should have been. But what changed in this game is when you go back and you watch last year's Ram game, he was just blowing past Havenstein. Havenstein couldn't handle the speed. And this year, Havenstein knew how to handle the speed. And I would argue that Havenstein knew it was coming, and so he was better prepared to handle it this year. And I think that's ultimately been the story of Vic Beasley's 2017 season, is basically offensive tackles made adjustments. And they realized, oh, he's a one-note guy. If you can stop his speed rush, you can stop Vic Beasley. And I think we saw that towards the end of last season. If you go back and you look at, you know, you look at the last three games of the regular season, you look at the playoff games where Vic Beasley wasn't really that impactful as a pass rusher, outside of the times when the Falcons were using stunts and whatnot, and using him as a spy against like Kaepernick and whatnot. But you go back and you watch that San Francisco game, every time he's trying to go up against Trent Brown, Trent Brown's just, oh, he's using speed. Well, I'm going to use my length and I'm going to knock you wide of the pocket, and Kaepernick's going to step up in the pocket. Cam Newton did that in the Carolina game. Drew Brees did that in the New Orleans game, you know, and on and on and on. And you go back and you look at Vic Beasley's sack production in 2016. Like, okay, he beat Havenstein. He beat Sam Brailer like a drum, because he could beat those guys. He could blow past those guys with his speed rush. Five of his 15 and a half sacks last year came off of that. Five of his sacks, though, were quote-unquote coverage, hustle, you know, him being a spy sacks. So two-thirds of his sacks last year were basically him facing guys that couldn't handle his speed or him just out-hustling guys. And, you know, you go back. Now, that still leaves like five and a half sacks that he had last year. And you'll find he got a sack against Mitchell Schwartz, which was a great play, probably his best pass rush of the year. But that was the only time he beat Mitchell Schwartz that entire game. So you even saw in that game, he beat Mitchell Schwartz with speed. Mitchell Schwartz adjusted, and he never beat Mitchell Schwartz again. Joe Barksdale in the San Diego game, he got Vic Beasley got him early in that game. He then got a sack strip that Claiborne picked up and scored a touchdown on. And then in the second half of that game, Barksdale adjusted to his speed, and Vic Beasley never really beat him with the speed rush. And then both those guys were effectively able to make the adjustments to slow down his speed rush. And basically, the point I'm trying to tell you is, if he didn't beat him with the speed, he wasn't beating those guys. And then you saw two more of his sacks coming off of stunts, going against Fluker in that San Diego game and Barnes in the Rams game. And then two others were against, or one and a half, I think, were against two backup right tackles, which were Vitae, who he probably won't face this week because Vitae's playing left tackle for the Eagles, and Michael Scofu, who replaced Sam Brailo in the fourth quarter of that Broncos game. It's not to sit here, and again, I don't want anybody to be like, oh, Aaron's going in on Vic Beasley, he's saying Vic Beasley's not a good pass rusher. But again, I think people saw the number of sacks last year and said, oh, he's a great pass rusher, he's an elite pass rusher, and instead of really looking at how he got those sacks and why he got those sacks. And so I think, again, you get these bad narratives where people are going to sit there and say, looking at the sack numbers and say, oh, Vic Beasley declined a lot this year. He's the same player, at least as a pass rusher, that he was a year ago. The difference is the quality of competition has gone up than it was a lot last year. And offensive tackles watch film too, and they're like, this is what he does. And because he doesn't have anything else in his repertoire, if we can stop that, we can stop him. And that's really been, to me, the story of the season, not the whole notion, oh, he drops in the coverage too much or whatever the case may be. So I think really what Beasley has to do is he has to be able to use his hands. I think in this Rams game, he rushed a lot without really any intention or plan. It seemed like when you watched him rush, like he would, you know, the ball would be snapped, he would have that get off. And when if he didn't beat Havenstein initially off the snap, you would see that moment, that hesitation where the wheels are grinding. Where he's like, okay, what am I going to throw at him? Bull rush, ineffective. Okay, let me see if I can still juke him and go by him, ineffective. Let me see if I can try to stop and start and loop back in, ineffective. And I think that was really the problem, and that's been the problem with Vic Beasley, because again, of that one skill that he has, that if you can stop that, there's not anything else there's nothing in his bag of tricks. And then he doesn't necessarily have a plan. Like, his plan was, I'm going to beat this guy with my speed. Couldn't beat him with the speed. Okay, well, I'm going to beat him with my bull rush. Couldn't beat him with his bull rush. And then he's basically a non-factor. So I think with Beasley, he has to work on his hands. He has to work on his hands. He has to get better at hands. I think a visit to Chuck Smith's passing camp or pass rushing camp this offseason would do him wonders, because I think it's done wonders for Adrian Claiborne's hand use. Remember, Adrian Claiborne is great with using his hands, but he only uses one hand. Like, Adrian Claiborne does not use his right hand. That's why he doesn't play left defensive end for the Falcons, because all his pass rush moves come with one arm, his left arm, the one that doesn't have the Herb's palsy. He almost never uses his right hand when it comes to rushing the quarterback. He's basically playing one-armed. But because he's developed his hand use so well and developed power and is explosive, and he has a multitude of moves, whether it's the rip, whether it's the chop, whether it's the arm over, or whether he's just going to get long levers on his left arm and just knock you back into the quarterback, he can do all those things. And that's really what Vic Beasley needs to learn how to do. And I think Chuck Smith could do a lot of wonders helping him, whether it's Chuck Smith, whether it's Bryant Young, whether it's Dwight Freeney, for all I care. I don't care who it is. Someone's got to teach him that stuff. And this is part of the reason why I'm a big believer in why he should play linebacker. Because if he doesn't get better, I don't really see that much upside as him as a pass rusher. Not to say that he shouldn't get opportunities to rush the quarterback, but I don't necessarily see why, like the Falcons have done in the last couple of weeks, where we got to get Vic Beasley more opportunities. Why? Tack McKinley's outplaying him. Adrian Claiborne's outplaying him. Brooks Reed's been outplaying him this year. I know that's blasphemy to say, but on a per-snap basis, because Brooks Reed, guess what? Brooks Reed has a counter move. Brooks Reed doesn't have the world's greatest first step. He's not going to just blow past all, except for bad, you know, the Havensteins of the world. He's not going to blow past those guys with speed. But guess what? He's going to set you up with speed and then use that counter move, that spin move that he loves so much, and beat you. And it's been very effective the last 2 years, hasn't it? You know, that's probably all Brooks Reed really has, but it works, right? And so it's one of those things where it's like, you got to have two moves. You can't just have one. And you see it with Tack. Tack has two moves. He has the bull rush. He has the speed rush, right? And he's gotten better at using his hands to knock down, you know, the chop hands. We talked about Claiborne, et cetera. So that's really been the problem with Vic Beasley. And for me, with him playing linebacker, like, he should get opportunities to rush the quarterback, obviously. But if all he's going to be is basically a speed and effort slash motor guy, why is that any different than what Devondre Campbell's bringing to the table as a blitzing linebacker that rushes the quarterback, you know, 5 to 8 times a game whenever the Falcons do decide to blitz, right? That's basically what Campbell's doing. He's not throwing moves at guys. He's just basically, I'm going to run by you, I'm going to run through you, right? And, you know, at this point in time, Campbell's much better at running through guys than Beasley is at this point. So, like, I don't see why Beasley necessarily needs to put his hand in the dirt 30 times a game and get after the quarterback, which has been what the Falcons have been trying to do these last couple of weeks to get him out of his funk. And again, I don't blame them for that, but I'm sitting here saying, like, if this is all he's going to be, this performance against Havenstein, then get Tack the reps, give Claiborne the reps, give Brooks Reed the reps, and put him somewhere else, because it's not getting done. So, you know, I think he still has a lot of upside for the linebacker position. I think, you know, speed and effort, speed and motor can go a lot longer at the linebacker spot, in my opinion, than they necessarily do at the defensive end spot. So it's not a judgment on Vic Beasley's future. I think he can, you know, he'll come back in 2018 with a perfectly clean slate for me. And we'll see how much development he's shown, how much improvement he's made. But if this is all he's going to be, then the Falcons might as well just move him to linebacker, in my opinion. Because this guy, if he's just going to be a one-note speed effort guy as an edge rusher without any real moves, without any counter moves, and basically the only times he ever consistently wins is against backup right tackles, that's nothing. You know, that's nothing to write your home about. And, you know, the 15.5 sacks was a great season, but he's not going to be able to repeat that again because NFL teams have figured him out. So that's it, guys. That's all I have to say about that. I hope that's not too much of a downer, but I feel like we have to be honest here and talk about Vic Beasley as a player and not come up with these lazy narratives. Oh, he's dropping in coverage too much. Oh, the team has misused him. You know, again, and certainly, you know, maybe if he had been spending those 6 or 7 weeks instead of playing linebacker, splitting his time at linebacker, maybe he could have developed more over that time period. But I doubt it. Like, he wasn't using moves in week one. why would you think he was going to be moved, and he's not using moves in week 18, so why do you think him not playing linebacker would have meant he would have been using moves in week 10? I don't know. I don't really buy that, but if people want to say that, then, you know, what can I say against them other than ranting about it on the podcast? So any other questions that you guys sent in? There's plenty more. I will answer those on LockedOnFalcons.com. Check that out on Friday, maybe Saturday morning, if I don't get everything done that I want to on Friday. And of course, you know, that gives you a little bit, couple more days, to at least one more day, to send in more questions if you have them. I said them at the top of the show, but I will remind you guys that you can send those in on Twitter at FalcFans. Just let me know it's podcast related. Otherwise, just send it over to the show's Twitter handle at Locked On Falcons. If you hate Twitter character limits, then use the email address LockedOnFalcons@mail.com. You can also hit us up on the Facebook page, Locked On Falcons. Give us a like while you're there, or post a comment at LockedOnFalcons.com or FalcFans.com, where the show is posted daily. So looking forward to this upcoming Eagles matchup. We will certainly have more Q&As throughout. Hopefully, you know, obviously we'll have at least one more next week. We'll see if we'll have another one pertaining to the Minnesota Vikings game following, or maybe the Saints game. You know, I want to play the Saints. I'm not worried about losing to the Saints. That used to be a thing that I was bothered by. Like, I remember back in 2010 when Vic was playing for the Eagles, and I didn't want to play the Eagles. I didn't want to have Michael Vick come into Atlanta and beat the Falcons on their home field. I didn't want to have to deal with that issue back then. But now, like, I'm not afraid of any team. Certainly not in the NFC this year. You know, I want to play the Saints. I don't want to play the Vikings. This offense struggles against good defenses. I think we can score against the Saints. I think we can outscore the Saints. I don't know if we can outscore the Vikings. We'll see. And maybe I'll change my opinion if we manage to do that against the Eagles, obviously. If we actually put up, you know, 23, 27, 24, 28 points against this Eagles defense, I'll be a lot more confident that we can take care of business with the Vikings. But the Vikings are the best defense that we're going to see this entire year, right? Unless Jacksonville magically makes it to the Super Bowl. So, like, I'm not afraid of the Saints. I would love, I know there's some Falcon fans that have trepidation, like, oh, man, if we play the Saints in the NFC Championship game, we lose, we'll never hear the end of it. But imagine how much joy you would get if the Falcons play the Saints in the NFC Championship game and beat them and go back to this. Oh, my God. Oh, it would be lovely. Oh, I pray. I wish and hope for that day to come. I really do. Oh, that would be glorious. So do not limit Falcon fans either that NFC Championship game should the Falcons win on Saturday, not to get ahead of ourselves, because certainly I'm not going to count my chickens before they hatch. But should the Falcons get to that next step, whether it's the Vikings and it's a revenge game, you know, if we play the Vikings, it'll be good because all the pressure will be on them. They're playing at home. The Super Bowl is going to be, you know, 2 weeks later in the same stadium. All the pressure is going to be on them. The Falcons will just be relaxed and whatnot. But at the same time, if we play the Saints, man. Oh, hate week for the NFC Ooh, that's going to be beautiful. That's going to be lovely. So, looking forward to that, should the Falcons take care of business this weekend. I hope they do. I think they will. So if I sound overly confident there, I think this Eagles team, as I've said multiple times on Twitter and on this podcast this past week, I think this Eagles team is a formidable matchup for the Falcons. But I'm confident that the Falcons have gotten it all figured out and will play a good round of football. They won't be perfect, but they will play a good enough game of football to beat this Eagles team. So, all right. So, extra long Q&A. I'm done rambling about upcoming matchups and upcoming Q&As. We will certainly keep the Q&A thing going throughout the offseason. That's originally what I was trying to get to before I fell into this. I digressed into NFC Championship matchups. But yeah, we will definitely keep the Q&As going throughout the offseason. So certainly looking forward to you guys sending in more questions. I'm sure a couple months from now, it's all going to be draft stuff. It's all going to be free agency stuff. You know, how much should we give Poe? How much should we do this? How much? But look, you know, sound dismissive now, but I'm looking forward to it. I'm looking forward to another long offseason of me ranting on this podcast about people overrating Vic Beasley's 2016 season, people overrating Austin Hooper's drops, people overrating whatever the case may be. You know, when I see, what was it that Steve said? when I see overconfidence from the fan base, I had to come in and check it or something like that. So I can't remember exactly what it said, but it was hilarious. All right. It's my mantra, right? Got to come and check some people. All right, guys. That's it. Stay locked on. Rise up. In brotherhood. All that hashtag nonsense.
You are Locked On Falcons, your daily Atlanta Falcons podcast. Part of the Locked On Podcast Network. Your team every day.